So we'll continue from where we left off last time. I'm going to continue with the top of the section on laxity. Yeah. So we're going through the five hindrances, you know, and the eight antidotes that are in Maitreya's text, distinguishing the center, the extremes from the center. Okay. And so we've talked about our favorite one, sensual pleasure. And we've talked about, oh, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong set. Okay, so the first one was, yeah, of the five faults, was laziness, not difficulty getting ourselves to the cushion, with the antidotes, confidence or faith, yeah, in the teachings on how to generate serenity, aspiration to generate it, effort to do it, and pliancy, a very flexible mind and body that can be quite easy to make it quite easy to abide in concentration. The second one was losing the object, or it's called forgetting the instruction. But what it is the instruction means your meditation object. So, you know, you sit down, oh, image of the Buddha, yes, 2 seconds later, off. Okay, so the remedy for that one is, the antidote is mindfulness. And mindfulness is the mental factor that remembers the object of concentration and helps, you know, and puts your mind on it. Yeah. So it isn't mindfulness, what mindfulness talks about, you know, on your app of just watching what arises in your mind. This is mindfulness of the specific meditation object. Yeah. The third one was, fault is two together, restlessness and laxity. Yeah. So they seem quite different from each other. Restlessness, where the mind's running around, worry, anxiety, planning, regrets, you know, what did that person say? What do they really mean? How do I feel about this? Psychoanalyzing ourselves and others on the cushion, you know it. Okay. So restlessness, and then laxity is the mind is kind of dull, yeah, and the mind's not clear, yeah. But they both are, the antidote for both of those is introspective awareness, which is that one that just checks up, you know, am I concentrating or not, and that then says, okay, I need to, you know, whatever is taking me away from the object, if something's taking me away, what's the antidote? And so it calls for that, to bring the antidote for. Okay, so that's the one we're on. We talked about restlessness, yeah, and we're talking about laxity now. And when you look, these are really what so much of our meditation sessions is about, isn't it? And how you can go in, you know, a flash of a second from being restless to being quite dull. And in another flash of a second from being quite dull to, you know, being restless because you thought of some exciting thing to think about. Yeah, like what you're gonna do tomorrow. You don't look excited. You should be excited. Yeah. Okay, so let's start with visualizing the mirror field and then taking refuge, generating bodhicitta. And remember, merit fields in front, we think of all sentient beings around us, and the people that we don't get along are right here between us and the Buddha. They're looking at the Buddha, Buddhas too, because they need spiritual guidance. And we're leading everybody to turn to the three jewels for that guidance. So to cultivate our motivation, begin by thinking about the kindness of sentient beings, and that everything you have, everything you know, everything you're able to do, all of this comes due to the kindness of sentient beings. Yeah, we didn't come into this world with all of our knowledge or the medicine that we need or clothes or food or anything. All came from others. So begin by contemplating that. And then think of the dukkha that all these sentient beings have, that they don't know anything about karma. They're pushed by afflictions and karma, and yet they don't feel like they have any power or control or anything they can do. They don't know that an alternative exists, that liberation and awakening are possible. So sentient beings spend their whole lives running around just basically trying to stay alive, and then try and get whatever pleasure they want, and try and defend against any threats or suffering. And so it keeps going like this, one life after the next, creating more and more karma with the afflictions one after another flaring up. And yet these are the very same sentient beings who have been so incredibly kind to us. So it's hard to see their suffering, their dukkha. And this arises compassion in us, wanting to reach out and be able to help them. But when we look at ourselves, yeah, are we good guides? No, we are stuck in the same mess ourselves. So wanting to be of benefit, seeing our present limitations, having compassion and love for sentient beings, then we realize that we have to transform our own minds. Yeah, gain full love and compassion, full wisdom, full renunciation. All the different qualities of bodhisattvas and Buddhas. And then we can help others while we're on the path, but when we attain Buddhahood, we'll be capable of doing so much more. So generate that bodhicitta aspiration to become Buddha. So this way of thinking, I find very helpful to keep my mind in a virtuous state in confront of what is going on in the world today, and especially what's going on in this country, you know, to be able to maintain compassion, see the suffering that and the dukkha that is caused by ignorance, and how ignorance produces the afflictions, which then lead to the creation of karma, which then ripens, and you know, we're reborn again and again. Yeah, and when I think of, you know, if I look at certain, let's say, political figures or so on, it's really easy to get like, oh, these people, you know? It's like, I think the things that really bother me the most is the lying, you know? Just the flat out lying. And then also the lack of care for other living beings, and instead the desire for revenge. Yeah. And so those things, you know, the lying and then the lack of care, the desire instead to harm and ignore the cruelty of some of the policies, these are the things that really disturb my mind. Yeah, but instead of, you know, before I met the Dharma, I would then go to anger, you know, just plain old anger, swearing at these people, calling them names, saying that they're hopeless, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm talking about. But now, having met the Dharma, I can look at their situation in samsara and just think, you know, they want happiness and they don't want suffering. And oh my goodness, the karma they're creating, the karma by this incredible amount of lying. Yeah, the karma from the incredible amount of just not caring about other living beings, even though that's supposed to be part of your job. You know, if you're in the government, you're a servant, yeah. And instead, the wish for retribution, the, you know, not caring about the cruelty and so on. So instead of getting angry at that, seeing how those people are so trapped by their ignorance, so unaware and pushed by their afflictions, And not knowing anything about the Dharma, not even thinking that what they're doing is non-virtuous. You know, no thought at all that, oh, I'm creating non-virtue, just because you don't care, virtue or non-virtue. Yeah. And that how, you know, just it keeps them in this again and again, you know. They're stuck in this cycle, and then they create, you know, cause, drag others along with them, which is what we do when we act in non-virtuous ways, is we adversely affect others, and they generate afflictions and more karma, and, you know. So when I think of all of that, then it's like, but I have to have compassion for all of us. You know, myself included, I'm not a Buddha, and, you know, for how we want happiness, and yet we're so blindsided by ignorance, afflictions, and karma, yeah, and that compassion is the only way to greet people like that, to look at people like that, you know, and to also look at myself. Instead of putting myself down, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm in the same boat. Okay, so, you know, given the situation that is happening in the world now, I think this is a very useful kind of meditation to do. Keep our minds, you know, clear and kind. Yeah. And give us some oomph to do our practice, because we see that, you know, if we can have more wisdom, more compassion, and so on, then there's even small things we can do to at least get people more aware of ethical conduct, you know, and emphasize the importance of ethical conduct, you know, and that if we can get, you know, whoever we can, even a little bit energized to think about ethical conduct and to be careful of their behavior, then, you know, we've done something quite useful in our lives and due to our practice, yeah. So the deeper our practice goes, then the more we can continue to do this. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to the text. If you want to, it might be good to take that motivation out and put it also, keep it in this, but put it as a separate BBC. Because so many people look at the BBCs for advice about, you know, how to deal with the world now. Okay, so we're on page 193. We'll start again with laxity. Yes, laxity. Yeah, isn't it nice? Space out. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, relax and laxity, you know. Yeah. And that all has to do with being lax. Yeah. But what we consider relaxing, you know, like sometimes we consider restlessness relaxing. Yeah. When you've been doing something quite serious, thinking, you know, about something in a very serious way. Oh, then restlessness. Okay, I can go watch a movie. I can go out with my friends, you know, go bowling, go miniature golf, go walk on a tightrope across Niagara Falls. You know, I can, yeah, those things just relax my mind. Yeah, or do kung fu. Yeah, practice your chop chop. And, you know, go bake chocolate cake, you know, whatever your thing is, yeah. And we consider that relaxing, but it's still the lax part. But that's restlessness, isn't it? So maybe laxity and, well, what's another name for restlessness that has the word lax in it? Energize lax. What? What? What'd you say?
Laxative is what came to mind.
Oh, laxative, yes. Okay. Yeah. Is that relaxing? Okay. So laxity differs from lethargy. Lethargy is the heaviness of body and mind that is close to sleep. Lethargy causes the decline of both stability, being able to keep the mind stable on the object, and clarity, the mind itself being clear. When we hear clarity, it doesn't mean the object is clear. It means the mind that's perceiving it is clear and alert. Okay? The mind is dull and passive. It may even begin to dream. This is lethargy. Lethargy isn't mentioned as one of the five faults because on higher levels of concentration, it is less frequent than laxity. But when laxity is mentioned, lethargy is implied. Okay? Because if you perfect your laxity, you're going to wind up with lethargy. Okay. At initial levels of practice, lethargy is a noticeable object for many people. Yeah. But as you practice more, then lethargy, you know, you begin to be able to stay awake and know the antidotes, you know, and keep yourself awake during the meditation. But then there's this laxity when you don't have so much clarity. So there's two kinds of laxity, coarse and subtle. Yeah. So when coarse laxity is present, there is some stability on the object. Yeah. So you have some mindfulness on the object, but the clarity has decreased. Okay. The object doesn't appear so clearly, and we may even start to lose it. Although the mind isn't distracted to another object, that's what restlessness does, and it is and isn't so drowsy, yeah, it lacks force. Okay. It remains in a vague state with an agreeable sensation. Perhaps it resembles what my Western friends call spaced out. Yeah? Some of our spaced out, I think, has some restlessness in it. You know, the mind is, you know, almost like dreaming or images floating through. This is you don't have so much of that, but, you know, you're a space case. Yeah. Somebody says, what are you thinking? And I, oh, nothing. Yeah, I was spaced out. Okay. Because the mind has become too withdrawn inside with laxity, the antidote to coarse laxity is to enlarge the scope of the meditation object. Make it brighter, elaborate on the details, okay? So make the colors bright, yeah? Really focus on, you know, like the details of exactly what it is. So if the meditation object is the image of the Buddha, you employ analysis to review the details of the Buddha's form. Here, analysis doesn't mean, you know, we hear the word analysis and we think, oh, I have to sit down and like analyze. analyze the details of the Buddha's form. How long is the Buddha's eyebrow? You know, no, that's not what we mean, okay? How many hairs in the Buddha's eyebrow? How about his eyelashes? We usually think of that as analysis. But here, it's not that tight kind of thing, but you're trying to be more aware of the details, okay? So don't start out right away counting the hairs in the Buddha's eyebrows, okay? Just, you know, look at his eyes and get, you know, make the eyes a little bit more vivid or clear, or just, you know, sometimes you get something, you know, on a detail and stay on that. Sometimes just get the whole general shape of the Buddha. He may be some kind of golden blob, but, you know, that's what you get at that moment, okay? But make it at least a bright golden blob so that your mind is more alert, yeah? And then you can continue to you know, gradually get the details better, okay? So make it brighter, elaborate on the details. If the meditation object is the image of the Buddha, employ analysis to review the details of the Buddha's form. Okay, so that's one antidote. Another one, visualizing bright light filling the room or looking at a light also helps. Okay, so yeah, bright light. If you're doing breathing meditation, imagine when you inhale that you're inhaling incredibly bright light. And when you exhale, you're exhaling darkness. Yeah, like dark smoke. But don't think, oh, I'm exhaling the dark smoke and now it's filling up the room and the room's becoming polluted and that's why everybody in the room is coughing. You know, just chill out, okay? yeah. So visualizing bright light filling the room or looking at a light also helps. If coarse laxity persists, temporarily leave the meditation object and contemplate a topic that will elevate your spirits and invigorate the mind. This does not mean an object of attachment, okay? For example, His Holiness says, precious human life, you know, really go through the 8 freedoms, the 10 fortunes, and really look at your life and go, wow, you know, what amazing fortune I have. You know, I could so easily have any one of the 8 hindrances or lack one of the 10 fortunes. So easily, yeah. And so make your mind happy thinking about that. Or think about the benefits of concentration, yeah. Being able to have a peaceful mind, focus your mind, how it aids in understanding all the other Dharma topics, okay. Or think about the benefits of bodhicitta, yeah. That, I mean, that can make your mind really happy too. Or just, yeah, and not think about, it's when we think about the benefits of bodhicitta, not like they're out there and the, you know, I'm reading a list of benefits, but like, wow, what would it feel like to be a bodhisattva myself and experience those benefits of bodhicitta? Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. For example, never to get angry again. That's just one benefit of bodhicitta. But just imagine, you know, if you're solid in your bodhicitta, people can say whatever they want about you. They could trash you up, down, and across. They could beat you up. But you're not going to get angry. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah? So think of these kind of benefits of bodhicitta. Or think of the excellent qualities of the three jewels. So that's what we covered in the initial chapters in this text. Yeah? So go back over, you know, what we covered and really think, you know, of the qualities of the three jewels. You know, go through them one by one and again think, wow, what would it be like to have those qualities, and how fortunate I am to have, you know, met a tradition that teaches me how to develop my mind and purify my mind to gain those qualities. So such reflection energizes the mind and makes it joyful. Yeah? So don't, you know, kind of like, oh, all the qualities of the Buddha are so wonderful. I'm so glad the Buddha has them, but I don't, poor me. Please, you know, don't do that. Yeah. So such reflection energizes the mind and makes it joyful. If coarse laxity still continues, visualize your spiritual mentor and make a request as described above. You know, requesting our spiritual mentor for their inspiration, for their blessings, whatever word you want to use. So to, you know, be able to generate concentration and cultivate the 10 antidotes and get rid of, you know, overcome the 5 faults, or, you know, do it with the 5 hindrances that we went through earlier and cultivating them, and, you know, make a request. Yeah. And then return to your meditation object. You know, just, you can think of your spiritual mentor and make the request, and then think that light from them comes into you and purifies your mind and, you know, disperses all the laxity. Okay, so that's for the coarse laxity. Then subtle laxity is the worst fault when trying to generate serenity. We don't suffer so much from this one yet. We're still with the lethargy. Maybe when we improve, we get to the coarse laxity. Okay, but subtle laxity, they say it's the worst one, and I'll tell you why. With it, the mind has become too relaxed. Although clarity remains and the mind may abide single-pointedly on the object, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Why is it a big hindrance? The freshness or vigor of the clarity has declined because the mind's grip on the object has become too loose. A subtle sluggishness, weakness, and lack of comprehension are present. Okay. The thing that is so difficult about the subtle laxity is you feel that there's still stability, there's still some clarity, even though it's not, you know, a lot. There's a very pleasant feeling. So you just stay in that. Yeah, and some people actually mistake the state of subtle laxity for serenity. And they say, oh, good, now I have serenity. No, you have subtle laxity. You don't have serenity. And it's hard to recognize apparent. So subtle laxity is difficult to recognize, because it's similar to samadhi in that both have stability and clarity, yeah, and both are characterized by the mind being peaceful and experiencing a pleasurable sensation. Because of these similarities, subtle laxity is especially dangerous. A meditator's breath may stop, yeah, not because she's dying, but because of the, you know, the subtle laxity, and that you are concentrated, so there's some concentration, but yeah, a meditator's breath may stop. She may sit in meditation for days. Afterwards, she may think she has attained serenity and make no effort to improve her meditation when in fact subtle laxity was present. So that's why it's so dangerous, yeah. Subtle laxity has many disadvantages. Our meditation doesn't become a cause to attain serenity. Yeah, because we're off in never, never land. Yeah, and that, you know, we may say, well, there's stability, there's some clarity. Isn't that getting me towards serenity? Well, that's nice, but we're so blocked by the subtle laxity, yeah, that our general mental state is not getting us there. Okay, our meditation doesn't become a cause to attain serenity, and we may become forgetful in this life and be born as an animal in the next. So if you're in that like nice, you know, mellow state, you're focused on the Buddha, some clarity, but you don't recognize that the mind isn't vivid, and you know, you're relaxed, it's really nice. Yeah, then, yeah, you may become forgetful in your life. Yeah, well, maybe this is a new scientific thing for people to investigate about Alzheimer's and dementia. Yeah, but yeah, even if you're young, this can happen. Mindfulness becomes weak and wisdom decreases. Eventually, coarse laxity returns and we may lose clarity completely. Okay, so if you have that subtle laxity, you're not going in the direction of serenity, you become forgetful in your life, yeah, maybe born an animal. Animal realm is known for their ignorance, yeah. In the next life, and then the mindfulness, your ability to concentrate on the object becomes weak, your wisdom decreases, and eventually laxity comes back, and maybe even lethargy, and you know, you think you're making progress, but you're stuck. Okay, someone once, this is holiness, someone once said to me, I have good concentration on the object, but I lack energy for the welfare of other beings. I believe this was because the person's meditation suffered from subtle laxity. Subtle laxity is like a tied donkey. It looks calm, but is ignorant. Correct concentration, on the other hand, should make the mind alert and vibrant. Yeah, so the person is saying, I can concentrate on the object, you know, the Buddha, the breath, whatever it is, but, you know, I don't have so much energy to care about other sentient beings. So I think this is, holiness is saying this in the context of somebody, you know, who's aspiring for the Mahayana path. Yeah, and so he thinks that's because of subtle laxity. Another person mentioned to me that while he was meditating to gain serenity, his mind became duller and he couldn't think as clearly. Ooh. I responded that this indicated that something was amiss in his meditation. He had not detected the presence of subtle laxity. Okay, so many disadvantages. Mind is duller, your wisdom decreases, you can't think so clearly, you become more forgetful. So that's why they say that it's such a severe hindrance. The remedy for subtle laxity is to hold the meditation object more firmly and tighten the mode of apprehension of the object. In other words, yeah, focus your mind on the object, hold the object more tightly, but you have to balance it, because if you hold the object too tightly, yeah, like that, then your mind's gonna go over to restlessness. Okay, so tighten the mode of apprehension, how you're apprehending the object. But if we hold the object too tightly, restlessness may arise. Finding the right balance is like holding a tiny bird. Our grip must be neither too tight nor too loose. If you squeeze the bird, you're gonna hurt it. If it's too loose, it's gonna fall. The proper balance is developed only through experience. Sorry, no pills, no, the whole thing about balance, which is so important in our practice, just to be a balanced human being, is something that we have to learn through our own experience. I mean, we hear about what to look out for and what the remedies are, but to make ourselves balanced, we're the only one who can do it and can, you know, identify where, what we're hung up on and what we need to do. The proper balance is developed only through experience. If we err, it's better to err. If we err, it's better to be on the side of tightness, because restlessness is easier to recognize and overcome than laxity. Okay, so if you're going back and forth between restlessness and laxity, you know, if you can, you know, if you get too tight and you have the restlessness, that is definitely easier to recognize than the laxity. You know, because laxity, I mean, when your mind is restless, depending what you're restless about, if you're fantasizing about an object of attachment, you know, oh, I might want to stay in that for a while, but it's easier to recognize that your mind is caught up in, you know, a super duper attachment, than when you're, you know, kind of lax and in this, you know, mellow state, but without, the mind is not so vibrant. Okay. Skill is required to use introspective awareness properly to identify lethargy, laxity, distraction, and restlessness. So, you know, introspective awareness, that mind that monitors what our mind is on, that's the antidote to both the laxity side and the restlessness side. Because the introspective awareness is what identifies that our mind has gone under the influence of one of those. Okay, if our introspective awareness is weak, we won't recognize interruptions to concentrate until the bell rings. And then it's like, oh, where was I? Yeah. You ever had that happen? Okay, if our introspective awareness is weak, we won't recognize interruptions to concentration. If it's overactive, oh, am I on the object? Oh, am I still on the object? Oh, is the object clear? Oh, it's not so clear. Oh, you know, like that, okay. So if introspective is awareness is weak, we won't recognize interruptions to concentration. But if it's overactive, it interrupts the flow of concentration and prevents the mind from becoming stable, because it's starting to, it's like a parent that has a baby. And when the baby's too quiet, the parent is always looking in the room, you know, what's going on? Okay. So, you know, if you're keeping on looking in the room, you know, what's going on? What's going on? You're going to drive your kid crazy. Yeah. Well, in the same way, you know, the introspective awareness keeps saying, you know, what's going on in my mind? Yeah. And you just, yeah. It's not going to work. Mindfulness and introspective awareness go hand in hand. Mindfulness is like holding a full cup of water. Introspective awareness is like an occasional glance to see if the water is spilling. Yeah? So holding the water, your mind has to have a firm grip on it. Yeah, if you hold it too tight, you might crack the container. But, you know, if you don't check, then you could be sloshing the water all over the place. So you have to check to see if it's spilling. Initially, we aim for stability on the object through mindfulness. Okay, so that's the important thing when we start our practice of concentration, first to emphasize stability and have mindfulness, okay? Because we have to be able to stay on the object, yeah? And that mindfulness is what remembers the object. Later, when we are more familiar with the object and our attention span is longer, introspective awareness is needed to check for faults such as restlessness and laxity. Okay, so at the beginning, staying on the object is the problem. So that's why, you know, when we went over the five faults, yeah, laziness, not getting yourself there. But then that once you get yourself to the cushion, forgetting the instruction, not having stability on the object. So you have to do that. Then, you know, we get into the restlessness and laxity. And that's where the introspective awareness is like really vital. Until introspective awareness is strong, our meditation remains prey to these two faults. Yeah, because we get distracted and we don't notice it. Yeah. Initially, periods of laxity and restlessness are strong and frequent, right? Through practice, they become weaker, and periods of concentration on the object become longer. Through practice. That's the key word, practice. Yeah. In time, subtle laxity and restlessness lose their force and disappear because our introspective awareness is becoming stronger. Okay, so then we've covered the first three of the five faults. Yeah. The next one, the fourth one, non-application and its antidote, application of the antidote. Okay, so. Yeah, the fault is not applying the antidote, and the antidote is to apply the, you know, the fault of, you know, not having a clean room is not cleaning your room. Yeah, the antidote is clean your room. Okay, not pray. Yeah. Yeah. His Holiness talks about this a lot. You know, he says so many people just pray to the Buddha for these realizations to come. And, you know, prayer is nice, it energizes you, but you have to do the practice. You can't sit there and pray. There's a really good joke about that. What is it? Oh yeah, about the lottery ticket. Yeah, you know about, oh, you don't know, okay. So there's this, I think it's, yeah, it's, it, I initially heard it where as God was the chief figure, but we'll make Buddha the chief figure. So somebody goes to the temple and is praying, Buddha, 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 I want to win the library. I want to win the, well, that's good. You want to win a library. I want to win the lottery. Okay. Buddha, please, you know, you go to the temple one day, the next day, Buddha, please, you know, make it so we win the lottery. And the next day, Buddha, my family really needs the money, please, you know, make it so we can win the lottery. Please do something. And then that person, you know, hears the Buddha speak. The Buddha says, buy a lottery ticket. You're supposed to laugh. Okay, good, thank you. So you got to be practical. You got to do the practice. Buy your lottery ticket. Don't just pray to have single pointed concentration. Yeah. Okay. It's reminding me of another joke I heard about God, and we'll wait on that one. Okay. So it's similar. Non-application is not applying the antidote, even when we know restlessness or laxity is present. We know it, but the restlessness is so nice. I have this wonderful visualization of Buddha Boy, you know, and he parked his, you know, he ditched his white horse. And he got a red hot Porsche instead. Yes, you know. Okay. So the non-application, not applying the antidote, even we know laxity is present. It is similar to a general not sending out troops once a spy has discovered the enemy lurking about. Our country bombs a place before we have all the intelligence on it. That's over application. That's the next hindrance. Yeah, wait a paragraph. This is, you know, the general not sending out the troops once the spy has discovered the enemy lurking about. Yeah. Non-application occurs principally in the seventh of the nine stages of sustained attention, but something similar to it may occur earlier. Okay. Yeah, like when we're, you know, we know we're lethargic and we're, you know, dazing off, but it's, you know, it's kind of pleasant. I didn't have enough sleep, you know, 4 years ago, even though I've had enough sleep ever since. So, you know, I need to catch up for that sleep 4 years ago. You know, so you don't apply the antidote. So that becomes a problem. Okay, principally at the seventh stage. Yeah, but sometimes something similar may occur earlier. Yeah. The antidote is to apply the appropriate antidote to whichever fault has arisen and exert effort to eliminate it. Okay, so not just, I should think about impermanence, and then you go back to your object of attachment. Not like that. Okay, so holding the object and paying closer attention to it when laxity arises, and relaxing our mental grip on the object when restlessness is present. So that's the fourth one. Then the last one, fifth one, overapplication and its antidote, equanimity. So overapplication is excessive exertion. It occurs when we apply antidotes to restlessness and laxity, although they haven't occurred or have already been eliminated. Okay, so we're stuck and we're still applying the antidote. It resembles a parent correcting a child when the child is behaving well. It simply disturbs the child. Yeah. This fault occurs mainly in the eighth stage of sustained attention, although a similitude may occur earlier. The antidote to overapplication is equanimity, in which we relax our effort a little, but not too much. Okay, so the mind is kind of even and balanced. In short, the Indian sage Atisha advises us. This is Atisha's advice. Avoid all factors that hinder samadhi and cultivate conducive factors by applying the eight antidotes for eliminating negativities. This is the rubbing stick, free from the moisture of attachment, for igniting the fire of the spiritual path. Meditate in this way with intensity. So if you're trying to start a fire with rubbing two sticks together, has anybody ever done that? Yeah, it's easier with a match, isn't it? Okay, but apparently, you know, if you have moisture on your stick, it's not going to ignite. So it's so all these antidotes, it's like the rubbing stick, free from the moisture of attachment. Yeah, we use it to ignite the fire of the spiritual path through developing serenity. And so meditate in this way intensely. Okay, now a reflection. Okay, that has 3 points. So first point, identify each of the five faults in your own meditation. Which one is the most troublesome for your present level of development? Okay. So be aware, this is your homework. Yeah. Practice noticing each fault when it arises and applying its antidote. Do this over a period of time. So not just one day, 2 days, you know. And then 3, what change do you see in your meditation? If you're able to identify the hindrances and apply the antidotes over a period of time, yeah, it's going to be much easier to put your mind on the object and to keep it there, and the mind will be clearer when you're meditating. Okay, so now we're on to the 9 stages of sustained attention. Yeah, so the 9 stages of sustained attention and the 6 powers are explained in Asanga Shravaka Grounds and the Compendium of Knowledge, his Amidabha Samuchaya. Okay. So Vasubandhu wrote 1 Abhidharma text or commentary, and Asanga wrote the other one. And they were brothers, yeah, different fathers, but the same mother. And Asanga was Mahayana, Vasubandhu was, on the Shravaka path. And the big brother kind of got his little brother turned on to bodhicitta, and Vasubandhu became a Mahayana practitioner. Okay, so the nine stages of sustained attention are stages of concentration on the way to serenity. Okay, so it's by knowing these, it gives you some idea of how to evaluate where you are, yeah, in generating serenity. And remember, when you live an active life and you're running around doing all sorts of things, don't expect to have serenity. Yeah, because your mind is filled with all sorts of other things, thinking about it, you know. We got to furnish the Buddha hall, and we have to, there's a table downstairs in the which room, in the work room, the big long table, and we need somebody to bring it up and put it in the dedication room, and then we're going to carry up these beautiful statues. And are we going to put them in the elevator? No, we decided we'll carry them up. But what, you know, and we've also decided on the runner to put on it, but do we need to polish that table first? You know, so I mean, if all this is kind of going around in your mind, do you expect to sit down and all of a sudden, you know, there's the Buddha image, perfect, you know, samadhi? Yeah. So if it's that going to be that way, and we're living in a monastery, imagine if you have a job. Yeah, what your mind is going to be busy with. So we work to improve our concentration, but we have to be practical also. Okay, so there's six powers. So the six powers and the four types of attention help us to overcome faults, stabilize the mind on the object, and increase clarity. So here's more antidotes. In doing so, they enable meditators to progress sequentially through the nine stages. So here are the six powers. Okay, so through hearing is the first power, we learn the teachings on the method to cultivate serenity and place our mind on the observed object as instructed by our teacher. Yeah, so we got to start somewhere. Yeah, first we have to learn. Yeah, what is serenity? How do I meditate? What objects, you know, do I have? What are the distractions? How do I overcome them? Okay, so the first stage of sustained attention is accomplished by hearing. Yeah, so we gotta place our mind on the object. Then the second, through repeated reflection on the meditation object. So here reflection is the second power. We become able to stabilize the mind on the object for a short while. Reflection accomplishes the second stage of sustained attention. Now, okay, I can stay on the object for 30 seconds. Good. Yeah, then 31 seconds. Okay, then the third is mindfulness. You'll notice mindfulness coming up a lot. Yeah. In the three higher trainings, mindfulness is a big one. Yeah, it comes up in all three trainings. So mindfulness repeatedly brings the mind back to the object and accomplishes the third stage. Generated at the beginning of the session, mindfulness stabilizes the mind on the object and prevents distraction. So the fourth stage is attained. Okay, so that covers the third and the fourth stage. Yeah, because you're again trying to keep your focus on the object, and now it's getting better. Yeah. Then the fourth one, introspective awareness, it comes up again too. Yeah. So it sees the faults of discursive thoughts, auxiliary afflictions, and distraction to sense objects, and does not allow the mind to go towards other objects, thoughts, or emotions. Okay, now, it sees the faults of discursive thoughts. So we have to know what discursive thoughts are in order to see it, to recognize it, and to see its faults. Auxiliary afflictions, the 20 auxiliary afflictions. Yeah, do we know what they are? If we don't, we go to the mind and awareness text, low-rig text, yeah? I taught that some years ago. The tape should be on the website somewhere. And there's books about it. So to know what the auxiliary afflictions are, because again, if we don't know what they are, how are we going to recognize them when they come up? Okay, so it sees the faults of discursive thoughts, auxiliary afflictions, and distraction to sense objects. So this could be objects of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and all the various tactile sensations that we have. Yeah. So introspective awareness does not allow the mind to go towards other objects, thoughts, or emotions. But that's what's usually going on in our mind all day, isn't it? Other objects, what I have to do, what I don't feel like doing, how can I get out of doing it? Yeah. So other thoughts, feelings, oh, this is a pleasant feeling, I want more, this is an unpleasant feeling, how can I stop it? Yeah, emotions, oh, I have such strong emotions, I am so angry, you know, or I'm so attached, I can't get my mind off that piece of chocolate. You know, whatever it is, okay. Oh, you're dreaming about your next retreat. That's your object of attachment. I'm gonna go, I know where I can, you know, build a nice small hut, you know, complete with all my central heating and air con, and, you know, a beautiful altar, and a comfy bed, and nice place where there's nice weather, you know, and where people can come and bring me supplies. And you have, and you start designing it in your mind. Okay, I'll put the altar there, and the bed is going here. No, the bed's got to go that way. It doesn't face the, my feet don't face the altar. And I want a desk too, that will go over here. And what color carpeting? Yeah. Okay, you know? Okay. So we have to, introspective awareness does not allow the mind to go towards other objects, thoughts, or emotions. It helps to tame and calm the mind and becomes prominent during the fifth and sixth stages. So we'll get into the stages soon, and then you'll be able to link up these things with what's going on in each stage. Okay, the fifth of the six powers is effort. So effort exerts energy to eliminate even subtle discursive thoughts and auxiliary afflictions, and prevents the mind from getting involved with them. Yeah, we effort again, you know, in the three higher trainings, it comes again and again and again, you know, these same qualities, yeah. So preventing restlessness, laxity, and so forth from interfering with the flow of concentration, effort enables the meditator to focus the mind by releasing distractions. So effort, you know, works together with mindfulness on the object introspective awareness, keeping the mind there so it doesn't get so distracted. But then you need effort to have mindfulness and introspective awareness. Yeah, and through that effort, you prevent restlessness, laxity, and so on from interfering with the concentration. Okay, so it is prominent on the seventh and eighth stages. When it says this or such is prominent on such and such a stage, it doesn't mean that that is not practiced on the other stages. It just means it's the one that you really have to emphasize on that stage. Yeah, but for example, you know, all six of these we have to, of the powers, we have to practice on all the stages as best as we can. We have to remember the instructions. We have to reflect on them and, you know, have mindfulness on our object and introspective awareness and put effort on all of those things, yeah, on all the stages of practice. Okay, then the sixth power is complete familiarity with the above powers. So it's through that the mind spontaneously remains in samadhi. This power is found on the ninth stage. Okay, so your mind very easily stays in samadhi. You still don't have a serenity on the ninth stage. There's still some more things that you have to generate, have serenity, but you're getting close. Okay, then the four types of attention, they determine how the mind engages in the meditation object. Okay, so tight focus. Yeah, now we hear the word tight. I don't know about you. I think of, you know, I told you about the little girl at the, yeah. Some of you don't know the story. I was asked one time in Mexico to go to a Montessori school with the little kids, you know, and they wanted to learn to meditate. And so I said, you know, close your eyes and sit up straight and, you know, just watch your breath. And one little girl was there like this, you know, she really wanted to concentrate. Yeah. So when I hear tight focus, I think like that. That's not what the meaning here is, okay? So tight focus is used on the first and second stages of sustained attention to reinforce mindfulness, okay? So you don't just go, oh yeah, there's the image of the Buddha. It's like you have to hold it tightly, you know? When there is more stability, then your attention becomes interrupted focus, and that is used to attain the third through the seventh stages. So it's called interrupted because your mind is more stable, so you have to really exert more energy to be focused, not constantly, because sometimes your mind, you know, your mind is more on the object, so it's interrupted, yeah. Again, that doesn't mean you don't have focus on the object at that time. Okay, then third is uninterrupted focus. So that corresponds with the eighth stage. So there you can stay on the object. You're not getting distracted and fall, you know, lethargy. And then the fourth is spontaneous focus. So that's present with the ninth stage. Okay, so in looking at, you know, when we talk the five hindrances and then the five faults, these two sets, it seems to me that the five faults, what we're going through now, is really emphasizing more when you have some concentration, because the five hindrances are pretty gross hindrances, yeah? And Of course, the subtle forms are going to keep coming, but we start to really plug into them at the beginning. Whereas some of these other faults, we don't really see them so much at the beginning because other bigger faults are there. And but this is really pointing out the things as we go along, the different things that can come up. Okay, then Maitreya outlined the 9 stages of sustained attention in his Ornament of Mahayana Sutras. So here's a quote from it with 9 lines, and each line describes the activity of one stage. Okay, so first line, having directed the mind to the object of observation. Do not allow its continuum to be distracted. That makes sense. Having noticed distraction, quickly return the mind to that object. Yeah. And then fourth, the aware also withdraw the mind inwardly more and more. Yeah, so you're, when you have less distraction, the mind is more inward. Yeah, this is not talking about shutting down to other people, withdrawing as a person. You know, we have certain words that can be, you know, we have associations. You know, we hear, oh, withdrawing, oh, that's not good, you know. No, this is talking about in your meditation sessions, you don't want your mind flying out into the universe. You want to keep it here. You're withdrawing it. Okay. So the aware also withdraw the mind inwardly more and more. And fifth, then seeing the good benefits of concentration, tame the mind in concentration. Six, by seeing the faults of distraction, pacify dislike for concentration. Yeah, so dislike can be, you know, like a form of laziness. I don't feel like meditating right now. Seven, desire and so forth, as well as discomfort and so forth, likewise should be pacified immediately upon arising. So desire, our old friend, discomfort, the mind is ruminating, unhappy about something. Yeah, so we should deal with them immediately. Then eight, then those who make effort at restraint of faults need only make a little effort to concentrate the mind. So now the benefit is starting to come. And then nine, natural arising is attained. Aside from familiarizing with that, one desists from activity. Okay, so those are the lines that Maitreya said in his text. This is a good point to pause and see if you have questions or comments.
Venmo, it seems that subtle laxity is probably just discovered when you're speaking to your teacher about what's going on in your meditation, because it's so tricky to notice or even know that it's happening, sounds like, from...
What did you say is so difficult?
Subtle laxity. That you would only know that by talking to your teacher.
Yeah, I mean, or really, you know, if you remember what subtle laxity is and you remember to look for it, yeah, then you know, you may be able, hopefully, to do it yourself, but talking to your teacher would be very helpful.
And so at what level does subtle laxity?
That comes much later.
Much later. Is it going on even though we don't know what's going on, even like at this
beginning
level?
You know, at the initial stages, I think our problem is lethargy.
Yeah. Okay.
And then course, you know, when we get rid of the lethargy, we go to the coarse laxity. Yeah, the subtle one is, you know, it would be too subtle for us to even notice because we're involved in drowsiness or the coarse laxity.
It's somewhat disturbing that an advanced meditator could end up being forgetful and ending up in the next life as an animal.
Yeah. That's why you need to learn how to develop serenity, you know, and not just think, sit down, cross my legs, close my eyes, or stare at a candle, or, you know, any of these goofy ideas that people have. Yeah, I mean, this is exactly why we need to learn from the texts written by the experts. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, we develop our own ideas about things that are completely bananas. Yeah. So,
Two things. I'm assuming that someone would be caught in that subtle laxity for quite a while to develop the cause to be reborn as an animal.
Oh, yeah. It is.
Not just a one-off.
Yeah.
Slip into subtle.
Right. He was saying that's the fault of not noticing the subtle laxity. And so you're just in it. Yeah. So it's not just 5 minutes. You think you've attained serenity. Yeah.
And then Venerable, I'm wondering if a heading is missing right after the reflection on page 196 and before this next session of the nine stages. There was a heading before the the five faults and the eight antidotes. It seems like there should be a heading here for the nine stages. I'm sorry, maybe I have an older version.
What?
I have an older version on my computer.
Oh, so okay.
It's been corrected.
Okay. Other questions? Tracy.
I guess a couple of questions, but, and it may have nothing to do with this, but some people can really be very focused on like gaming or other online, just videos, what have you, and are they kind of tapping into that subtle laxity for the...
No, that's total distraction.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's not, you know, we think, oh yeah, I'm so focused on gaming, I can really concentrate. I can develop meditative serenity in no time. No, you can't. Your mind's going to be playing games. The whole, you know, gaming in all your meditation, because that's what you're familiar with.
And then there was a line in here, a meditator's breath may stop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of scary.
Yeah. Well, they don't die, but because the concentration is so deep, you know, they may have some subtle kind of breathing going on. Yeah. But we've read stories of, there was one boy in Nepal, remember that, who would sit under a tree just for days and days, and I think his breath may have stopped. Yeah. So it happens.
Else? Are samadhi and serenity synonymous? Are they interchangeable? Or what's
samadhi is the quality. Samadhi is translates as concentration. Yeah. So there's many levels of concentration. Yeah. They're not exactly the same, but you need samadhi to attain serenity. And often we use the word samadhi to refer to single-pointedness because, I mean, that is the quality. It's the mind being single-pointed. But when we just talk, oh, you know, somebody actualized samadhi, what we're usually meaning is like one of the serenity or one of the stages of in the form of formless realm.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, I wonder if it's it seems quite difficult to cultivate serenity using a more complex visual object, like visualizing Pure Land, right? Or, you know, I love the refuge field, for example, but I can get restless because there's like, oh, so much happening.
So much, right.
And getting into all that detail. Is it actually possible to?
Yeah. Well, you would start with the Buddha, just one figure, and, you know, really get your concentration very, very good on that before you start imagining Maitreya on one side and Manjushri on the other and filling it out. If you start out with something enormous like that at the beginning, forget it, yeah. So I think the figure of the Buddha is probably, you know, complex enough to maintain our focus on. Okay. Mm-hmm. But what will happen is as you improve your concentration, let's say on the Buddha, then when you visualize the merit field, everything's going to be much clearer, you know, and easier to get a feeling for that.
Venerable, these stages that you are mentioning, are they related to the uninterrupted path?
The what?
Uninterrupted path.
Uninterrupted path. No. Well, they are. In the sense that you have to have you have to have samadhi to gain an uninterrupted path. Okay. Now, just because you see the word uninterrupted here, it still means, you know, what you're interrupting is different. Okay. Okay. Yeah. When you're focusing on something and the lunch bell rings, that's also interrupted, but it's different. Okay, let's dedicate.